Hi, Guns Unpacked listeners. We do our best to make sure that episodes are timely and accurate, but these days, the world, including the world of firearms, is changing at a chaotic and fast-paced speed. Our commitment to building a better gun debate is not subject to change, but specific events, policies, and trends may have shifted by the time you listen to this podcast episode. Thank you for tuning in to in-depth conversations about guns that transcend the typical gun divides.
This is Guns Unpacked, a podcast where we interrogate, engage, and elevate the terms of the gun debate as we know it. I'm your host, Alex Young, Associate Director of the Bridges Initiative at Arizona State University, where we aim to bring research and innovation into the debate on guns in society. My guests today are Emily Ferris and Miria Holman. Emily is an associate professor of political science and a core faculty member in comparative race and ethnic studies at Texas Christian University. And Miria is an associate professor at the Hobby School of Public Affairs at the University of Houston. She is the author of The Hidden Face of Local Power, forthcoming from Temple University Press this year. Together, Emily and Miria are the authors of The Power of the Badge, Sheriffs and Inequality in the United States, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2024. Emily and Miria, welcome to Guns Unpacked.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you here today and have really enjoyed spending time over the last few weeks with this important book. I'm looking forward to digging into some of the fascinating intersections between the politics of the sheriff's office and gun culture more broadly. But I wanted to start with a kind of funny story. You both mention in the beginning of your book that sort of experiences with rural places and sheriffs kind of shaped your interest in the subject. And as I was reading, I kept thinking about a particular sheriff from my past. So I grew up mainly in Tulsa, Oklahoma, you know, mid-sized city where sheriff was involved in law enforcement, of course, but didn't really think twice about the office of the sheriff, right? But then my extended family had rural roots throughout Oklahoma and Colorado, and I often spent time as a kid in this town in Colorado called Westcliff, tiny town of a few hundred people in Custer County, which in the 90s had like around 2,000 residents, only has 5,500 or so today. And the sheriff while I was growing up was this guy named Fred Job, and he had been installed as sheriff in the mid-70s, and he served until 2014. And he was kind of the most publicly out there civic figure in the county. You know, he would ride in the parades at the rodeo and 4th of July and all this. He was really active in the local Republican Party, an important member of his church. He was a singer too and would sing country at these local jam nights at a local bar, just kind of in so many ways the face of the county. And then, you know, I didn't think twice about him after I left Westcliff and, you know, went on with my career until I started working on guns. And then in 2013, I saw his name again when he was the plaintiff in a fairly high-profile gun lawsuit, which was Cook et al. Versus Hickenlooper in 2013, which was the challenge to the gun control laws, including magazine capacity restrictions and things like that, that were passed after the Aurora theater shooting in 2012. This is just one of those funny anecdotes from my past that I always assumed was kind of related more to the exceptionality of Custer County, right? It's this weird rural Colorado county that is really invested in kind of the romance of the Old West. You know, Sheriff Job wore a Stetson and all that. But as I was reading your book, I came to realize, oh my God, there are more things about this figure that are kind of representative of the office of the sheriff in the United States than were exceptional in some ways. So I wanted to ask, do you think that's true? And were there sheriffs in your past that kind of inspired your interest in this topic?
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, he sort of checks a lot of the items that Emily and I would identify as things that make sheriffs this unique office. So many sheriffs hold an office for a very long period of time. They're elected, but they very rarely face electoral competition. And I would imagine that if you went back and looked at the elections in Custer County, there's many elections where your sheriff is either running unopposed or doesn't have quality challengers. There's this sort of idea that sheriffs represent something associated with the Old West. Many sheriffs ride horses, wear cowboy hats, dress the part, we might say. And your sheriff represents in many ways the role of sheriffs in the modern gun control debate, which is that sheriffs have ended up, for a variety of reasons, very firmly on the side of gun rights over gun control, and have been very prominent and vocal supporters of large-scale lawsuits against states and the federal government in efforts to draw back or remove gun restrictions that have actually made it through the legislative process. The sheriffs that I grew up with represent these sort of common patterns as well. So I grew up in Josephine County, Oregon, which is a very rural area of the state, the southwestern corner of the state. And the sheriff election was an important election in a place where there was almost nothing except for county level law enforcement. So for example, I grew up in a very rural area without any kind of municipal police department. So you called the sheriff or you called nobody if there was an issue. And early on in Emily and I's research experience in starting to think about sheriffs, the sheriff of Josephine County stood out because he was one of the original very vocal supporters of the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association's opposition to the efforts by the Obama administration to institute gun control post Sandy Hook shooting. And so he was one of the original people that signed a letter saying that he would oppose any kind of federal gun control, that it was unconstitutional, and that he had the capacity as a constitutional officer to decide whether or not gun control was constitutional in his county and decide whether or not he would enforce federal gun control. As soon as I saw the name of the sheriff pass by, I was like, oh, what is happening? That, I know that sheriff. I spent a lot of time in that county. And so sort of, we often think about these sort of as these unique experiences, but the reality is that there are a lot of commonalities of sheriffs across the United States. There's more than 3,200 of them, but a lot of them pulled these same patterns.
Yeah, and I think for myself growing up in Alabama, I grew up in an urban county. So, you know, a little bit of a different experience there, but same demographics as what you all are talking about. Jefferson County, where I grew up, didn't get its first African-American sheriff until 2018 in its history. And so, right, this is home of Birmingham. And I came to this project, you know, really interested in the longer history of sheriffs in Alabama and their role in the civil rights movement, right? And the role of race, which certainly intersects a lot of gun issues as well, too, and the ability of the state to use force against different communities. And so even growing up, I think, in an urban area, right, like some of these same demographic patterns, same questions, issues are still present.
Yeah, that's a fascinating contrast that insofar as your experiences with the Office of the Sheriff that I think speak to the terrain that your book covers. And one of the most fascinating aspects of that terrain for me was how you kind of both trace the history of the Office of the Sheriff kind of all the way back into English common law, but also bring to your reader's attention something I never realized, that many county sheriff's office in the United States on their own websites sort of represent and mythologize in many ways that history of the office in very particular ways. So I wonder, could you sort of summarize quickly that long history of the sheriff's office and talk a little bit about how some of the sheriffs that you were studying represent that history to the public?
Sure. So some of Alabama is actually a great example and where we kind of start the book as well, too. The Alabama State Sheriff's Association has one of these histories, which is, you know, as you say, not uncommon to see sheriffs themselves have a history of the office. And that's really unique, right? Like, we don't see mayors or state legislators write like a history of the office. And it is, you know, Mary and I argue purposeful because they're trying to frame the office in a certain light. And the Alabama Sheriff's Association, it's particularly notable because the history starts in, right, like medieval times with the office of the Shire Reeve, which was a kind of like a county, but really under the king's control. And the sheriff was the king's man to enforce all law and deal with taxes, etc. And so the Alabama Sheriff's Association starts all the far back and then, you know, comes to America and talks about how with the colonists, the office comes to America, but there's an important change in that they become elected officials and much less the king's man, right? And now the county's person. And so as Alabama sheriffs kind of move through time, their website does this massive jump over the very issues that I was talking about from Reconstruction all the way through the Civil Rights Movement and then jumps into modern era. And that's one of the things that we noticed frequently about these websites is that they often omitted this more robust and critical history of the office and its role in enforcing white supremacy and maintaining, you know, certain class and societal orders. And that was a history we thought was missing and wanted to include in the book.
Yeah, one of the things that we quote from the Alabama Sheriff's Association that we highlight in the book is that they had on their website, "The sheriff today continues to hold the respect and admirations of the citizens they protect. It's never lost the dignity it's enjoyed since its inception in the Middle Ages." I feel very comfortable saying I don't think that that's true. I don't think that it's possible that you can have an office since the Middle Ages that's never lost dignity. So that's an example for us of the way that sheriffs sort of create this idea that there's this very long, very dignified history, but in doing so present a very slim piece of what sheriffs have actually done across time.
Yeah, and in your analysis of the office itself, I find that you make a really compelling case that the role that sheriffs played in the enforcement of Jim Crow and multiple aspects of sort of racial domination in the United States, right, could be attributable not just to the fact that county sheriffs were the law of the land in rural counties or that many sheriffs happen to be right-leaning or hold beliefs about white supremacy, but rather that the sort of structure of the office has baked into it certain problems, right? And one of the most shocking that I found was that, you know, because sheriffs are law enforcement officers who are also elected officials, one would think, right, that there'd be a certain amount of accountability built in to that office that is not built into other law enforcement offices. But in your analysis, it really comes out that that accountability is not everything we might want it to be. Could you speak to how that works and what you found in terms of elections as mechanisms for holding sheriffs accountable?
Yeah, so sheriffs themselves, you know, really point to elections as the thing that makes them unique and that presents this accountability. The National Sheriffs Association talks a lot about the importance of elections. Individual sheriffs talk a lot about the importance of elections. But the fact is that sheriffs enjoy very high rates of incumbency, much higher than other locally elected officials or compared to, say, police chiefs who are appointed. They also very rarely face quality electoral competition. And so when we think about elections as a tool of accountability, people need to be able to choose between options if we think that elections are holding people accountable. But sheriffs very rarely face quality challengers. And we make the argument that one of the reasons for this is because in many ways they control what we refer to as the eligibility pool. So when we think broadly about the eligibility pool for political office, this is the group of people who are, you know, qualified to hold the office, that are likely to be interested in holding the office. We might think of, for example, something like the eligibility pool for the president includes the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives and governors, things like that. But for sheriffs, the vast majority of sheriffs emerge out of law enforcement backgrounds. So they first serve as a deputy, for example, or a jailer before they become sheriffs. And most sheriffs serve in their own office before they run for the office. Sheriffs essentially manage the people that might be their electoral competition. Imagine that you want a promotion, and in order to get that promotion, you're going to need to challenge your boss in an election. We might think that that sets up some bad incentives, some ways that we would see that sheriffs would engage in actions to try to limit who challenges them. And so we present both quantitative and qualitative evidence in the book about how sheriffs limit the ability of their challengers to run for office. They fire people that run against them. They fire people that vote for or campaign for their opponents. They use the tools of their office, including things like hiring, firing, and pay, to punish their employees when a challenger runs against them. And so it's not an environment that is really friendly to a lot of electoral competition. So it's lacking this central component of elections being a tool of accountability.
As you make that case, you also cover a couple of instances, right, in which control of sheriff's offices have turned over in a competitive election. What do you sense, you know, creates the conditions for change in those rare instances when we do see a competitive election and change in a sheriff's office?
I think that's a great question. I'm not sure as much we know that answer yet. That's actually the focus of one of our next books that we're trying to figure out, is how do voters evaluate sheriffs? What do the sheriff's elections look like more specifically? Because there's a lot of elections, obviously, if you have 3,000 some sheriffs, but we haven't really gotten a lot of great data on that in terms of the, you know, kind of nitty-gritty details of the competitive sheriff elections.
We do know that in some circumstances where we've seen, for example, progressive challengers emerge and be successful, that then those leaders face a whole set of challenges of their own once they take over these offices. One question might be whether or not it is possible to exert sort of individual level change in sheriff's offices, or is there so much dependent on culture and tradition in these places that even if you change who the leader is, you still need to change a lot more about what's happening in the office to really, you know, exert some kind of something that actually results in a change for criminal justice policy.
Yeah, a good example of this is yesterday I teach a class on race class in U.S. policing, and we were talking about the L.A. Sheriff's Department, which is, you know, the largest law enforcement agency in the United States, who has had series of scandals, and I saw two different news stories about them in the news today. And my students and I were talking about how one of these progressive challengers took over office and is trying to deal with the issue of deputy gangs, and it's taken him, now I guess we're on year three, to even get a policy that says let's not have gangs, essentially, and only two deputies have been fired, even though we have evidence going back to the 1970s that this is a problem within the office. The real challenge, right? Like, if he wants to control his deputies, he's going to likely face a challenger from within, potentially, in the next election.
I wonder if we might shift gears a little bit. So, you know, if the electoral nature of the office is one of the things that makes sheriffs exceptional among law enforcement officers in the United States, another aspect of the office that you point to that is remarkable is just the scope of county sheriff's powers, especially perhaps in those smaller rural counties, right, where they're the only law enforcement office going, right? And early on in your argument, you suggest that changes in the early 20th century, which you sum up as liquor, cars, and guns, really affected a major shift in sheriff's powers. Could you speak to how that historical change happened, and perhaps particularly how the rise in gun violence in the 20th century started to transform the office?
Yeah, so sheriffs are interesting in the United States. You know, a lot of the scholarship on criminal justice in the United States rightfully focuses on large urban police departments. And that's important. And we've learned a lot about the challenges of criminal justice reform from that context. We've learned a lot about what works and what doesn't work. But sheriffs are interesting to study because some of them represent very urban areas, like the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department. But many sheriffs represent very rural counties in the United States. So there's several sheriffs in the United States where the sheriff is the only employee of the sheriff's office in his county, because it's a county of, you know, 70 or 150 or 2,000 people. And so it's a place where the sheriff is responsible for a lot of land and not very many people. And so when we think about the transformations in the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s of the advent of the personal automobile, meaning that people in rural areas could move much more quickly around their area, the increased access to firearms, and then prohibition and efforts towards prohibition, and then the post-prohibition efforts to access alcohol. All of these presented unique challenges in cities. And we think about, for example, Chicago, right, in the 1920s, but also presented really unique challenges for sheriffs representing rural areas. And so it used to be that sheriffs had a very clear idea of what the population was in their county and how quickly people could move in and out of their county because people had to ride a horse in or out, right? Or a wagon. And now you have cars, which means that people can move around more quickly. So then you need to have deputies who also have cars. And really, prior to this point, sheriff's deputies are not even given uniforms, right? They are deputized, they're given a badge, and that's kind of it. There's no effort at professionalization. And so this push really starts to require that sheriffs think about hiring people. How do you pay for equipment? Do you give your own deputies guns? And it starts to push sheriffs and sheriff's departments and offices towards professionalization, something that they were very much reluctant to engage in, even as professional police departments were emerging in large cities.
Is there still a lag there in terms of professionalization and training? I was fascinated in your appendix by some of the statistics on sheriffs and education, right? Are there still a lot of people serving as deputies and in the office of sheriff itself who don't have as much formal training as law enforcement officers in a lot of urban police departments?
I think yes, but the gap isn't as large as the past, right? The certification requirements, although they sometimes exempt the sheriff, or sheriffs sometimes run into problems passing certification requirements once elected, but those I think have helped across the board, but there's still gaps.
Yeah, so this kind of unique confluence of characteristics of sheriffs. This book really helped me put together the pieces on something I'd wondered about for a long time. As a scholar of right-wing extremism myself, you know, I had come in contact, of course, with the constitutional sheriffs movement and thought about them in relation to other aspects of the paramilitary right. But learning the history that your book lays out, right, I think it's easy to see how, you know, this history of this sheriff stretching back, you know, all the way back to the early modern medieval period, coupled with the scope of their powers, their status as elected officials who nonetheless are not held very accountable, kind of sets up this movement that is a part of the kind of radical ecosystem of the right today, but in some way also feels like it's rooted in the history of the office. I wonder if you could address a little bit how you understand the emergence of the sort of constitutional sheriff's movement in relation to the kind of normative history of the office.
You know, I think in many ways this is an office ripe for some of those ideas that have been longstanding within right-wing extremist movements to take hold, right? This is an office of white men who are increasingly more conservative than even their counties, of course, but that also, you know, this is an office that is very concerned with justifying its power and trying to connect its power back to the individual residents of its counties, right? Through their ideas of elections for that. And so the older, you know, right-wing extremist ideas of county supremacy and posse comitatus, right, help feed into some of this mythology of a all-powerful sheriff who is there to protect residents in the goals that are aligned for white supremacy. Some of the older right-wing extremism, a posse comitatus, et cetera, in the 1970s into the 1980s, right, that particularly emerged in the West, where we see sheriffs that are also tend to have more power, the like interesting shift of an anti-government movement to then capture government officials as part of its own, you know, strategy is a really fascinating effort that emerges, you know, in its kind of current modern day form in the Tea Party era with former sheriff Richard Mack, and is able to repackage and purpose some of these ideas into a story that tells sheriffs that they are essentially all powerful in interpreting the Constitution and pursuing the policies that they want to pursue on behalf of their residents, even if other elected officials oppose this.
And one of the things that, you know, we think is very interesting, connecting some of the pieces that you have brought up, this obsession with the past is not new for sheriffs. Sheriffs for a very long time have been obsessed with the past, but it also really aligns with this sort of right-wing, broader nostalgia for the way things were, right? So a lot of right-wing extremism is we need to return to some, you know, mythical version of the past where everything was great and we had no problems. And, you know, nobody saw race in the 1950s. And so we didn't even have to deal with the idea of race. And so this idea that sheriffs have of our power extends back into the past then links directly to this nostalgia among the broader right-wing community of, you know, we need to like hearken back to the good old days. Well, guess who was law enforcement in the good old days? Sheriffs. And they continue to sort of play the role that we think of when we think of law enforcement back in the good old days, wearing the hat, wearing the boots, riding the horses, driving around, and, you know, being this sort of form of social control in their communities. That's really what sheriffs would like to do. That's the role that they play today. And so they're just ideally suited for sort of slipping into that slot among right-wing ecosystem.
In my own study of the militia movement and the paramilitary right more broadly, I've often kind of chafed at that term anti-government movement, which is so ubiquitous in scholarship, but also in liberal politics to describe a lot of what's going on in that world, right? Just because I feel like it's never been revolutionary as such. You know, it has this fundamental nostalgia and the sheriffs making the county great again or whatever. And that nostalgia leads back to an almost kind of mythic understanding of constitutionalism. And to me, your history of the constitutional sheriffs in so many ways showed how that's true, right? If the broader movement is interested in this radical notion of kind of local control of constitutional interpretation, sheriffs have been playing that role for a long time in some ways, have they not?
For a very long time. And challenging the federal government, particularly the federal government, whenever the federal government engages any kind of action that sheriffs view as a threat to expanding their power, right? So when we think about, for example, sheriffs' role during Jim Crow, during the civil rights movement, sheriffs broadly were not on the side of racial equality during those movements. And in fact, they were very interested in let's protect the status quo and let's protect my power in the community, right? So when we think about the power of sheriffs in the U.S. South in the 40s and 50s and 60s, part of that power was situated in this idea that the role of the sheriff was to maintain racial segregation and inequality and to punish members of either racial group, but particularly Black people who attempted to get across that. And so if you're saying, well, we're going to take away this legal version of segregation, we're going to take away the legal ability to engage in racism, you're taking power away from sheriffs. And so it's very natural that they would be chafing against this. Natural being like, if you give a mouse a cookie, he's going to want to continue to have cookies. And so the history of this is not, we trace it back to Posse Comitatus and the militia movements, but the history of the sheriffs being interested in efforts that are going to extend their power is not new, and it's not the Constitutional Sheriffs Association. It's a long history of sheriffs being interested in ways to increase their power or hold on to it.
I agree. And what is new in the context of the work of Y'all's Center is that sheriffs have shifted, though, on this issue of guns. You know, if we go back to the earlier gun reform effort, 60s, 70s, even into the 80s and 90s, sheriffs weren't all that different. They were testifying before Congress like police chiefs and saying, you know, the rise of deadly weapons are a risk to our officers. And, right, this what we were talking about earlier with the need of modern equipment to deal with these kinds of issues. And it's an opportunistic movement to draw sheriffs into really changing some positions on guns that, you know, Mack was recruited to the case that made him famous by the NRA. He goes on and becomes a lobbyist for the Gun Owners of America, right, who have these ties. And so it's the shifting of sheriffs on guns in service of this longer history, right, of wanting to expand their powers is an interesting development as part of this.
I've studied this for a long time, but I have to admit, I was shocked by some of the responses from your survey. To me, were so remarkable. Looking at a couple of them, right? Sheriffs are America's last hope and truly stand between tyranny and our constituencies. Then another sheriff says, sheriff's offices nationwide are the best protection against advancing tyranny by state and federal governments. We have arrived at this place, right, where sheriffs are really taking this stand on national politics in an intense way, which doesn't exactly feel unexpected given the history of the office, but the 21st century sheriff's movement is especially robust in its engagement with those national questions. Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting, right? Because, again, sort of connecting to your research and thinking about sheriffs, say, in the 80s and early 90s and the militia movements, sheriffs are like, please stop shooting people in the county, right? Like, they are not interested in supporting the militia movements. They're like, when posse comitatus people are like, we think that sheriffs are really important, sheriffs are like, if you could just like leave us out of it, that would be great. But what we see is this very successful campaign by Mack, by right-wing extremists, by the Tea Party, by the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association to recruit, systematically recruit sheriffs into these more right-wing attitudes. And one of the things that I think is very important in thinking about this is that the recruitment pattern starts with very reasonable preferences that sheriffs have about their interactions with the federal government. So if we think about something like the shooting in Ruby Ridge or the Waco catastrophe, in both of those circumstances, sheriffs knew that there was weird stuff happening and were very aware that there were violent people with guns and were like trying to figure out a way to save people. And in both circumstances, there was this attitude by the local sheriffs and then broader sheriff community that if the federal government had just stopped and talked to local law enforcement more, there could have been an avoidance of casualties, particularly of women and children, right? So that, you know, at that foundation, that's a very reasonable thing. We might think that, yes, we should do that. We should see cooperation between the federal government and local law enforcement, and we should particularly give privilege to local law enforcement who are aware of the local context of what's happening. But then we go from that to saying, actually, the federal government has to get my permission before it comes into my county, right? So that goes from sort of a very reasonable thing that is based in facts and is based in these bad things that have happened to a more extreme view. Or, you know, like something like telling sheriffs, like, you need to protect this people that live in your county. Yeah, absolutely. We agree. We all agree that sheriffs should be protecting the people that live in your county. And it's like, from the federal government. Oh, okay. And so, you know, part of the allure of this has been that it's based in these very real concerns that sheriffs have had about things that have happened in the United States. And then it has moved into these more extreme areas, but this sort of cultivation of these views is very much based in things that a broad set of sheriffs would agree with.
Yeah, and there have been these interesting outlier cases. I was thinking of the Mellor Wildlife Refuge occupation too, where the Harney County Sheriff played this crucial role in kind of trying to mediate that situation. But looking towards the future of this kind of politics and the sheriff's office, I wonder if we might talk about another figure that comes into your book and is indicative of so many of the more kind of disturbing trends you identify vis-a-vis racial politics and the role of sheriffs in national politics, who's Mark Lamb, the Pinal County Sheriff. He resigned in 2024 when he was running for Senate here in Arizona. So could you speak a little bit about the radical movement he started? And I mean, is Mark Lamb indicative of the kind of politics we could see emerging from the sheriff's office in the future, do you think?
That's an interesting idea. So Mark Lamb has, or had, I don't think it's actually still active, the Protect America Now, which is somewhat of a, was a sister organization to Mac's organization, CSPOA, overlap in terms of who's involved, et cetera. Mac certainly likes a stage and is willing to share the stage with all kinds of unsavory characters. But I would say that Lamb perhaps enjoyed stage even more so, and wanted, had national ambitions, right, in running for Senate in Arizona for that, and writing a book. Even his wife wrote a book, the sheriff's wife, trying to get his own TV shows, et cetera. And so I think Mac more so wanted to recruit other sheriffs to the cause, while Lamb wanted to expand his own profile and cement kind of, right, like this mythological, like the features of a sheriff that we've discussed before too. Where I see some troubling patterns, right, with Lamb is January 6th. And even just, right, like more broadly, all the things that have happened with COVID-19 mandates as well too. And so Lamb was regularly appearing either on his own channels or on news media to really criticize the Biden administration, to be a strong supporter of Trump, to even, you know, support January 6th false narratives of a stolen election, to the point where even, I can't remember who, but a Capitol Police officer tweeted back at Lamb, essentially being like, please stop, you know, and so having the fight amongst law enforcement over this issue. I'm not sure what's next for Lamb's career, but we see others as well too, right? Like Dar Leaf in Michigan is also, and so the spread of the cause to issues beyond guns and even beyond immigration, which has been historically kind of CSPOA's area, to now things like January 6th and election security and the role of sheriffs maybe in doing some of that work is really troubling to me.
Yeah, I mean, I would say Lamb represents in some ways to me what would be the natural next step if you have a whole organization aimed, a whole, you know, infrastructure aimed at recruiting sheriffs towards right-wing views. Why wouldn't you have more people try to step up and be the spokesmen, we'll say spokesmen, there are not very many women, for these organizations and views? On the other hand, you know, I think Lamb is interesting because he very clearly saw the sheriff's office as a tool to move up, right? So he's a sheriff and he uses this as an opportunity to gain a seat on Fox News stories and this television show and develop this national profile so that he can do other things. The interesting thing for me are that there's a lot of sheriffs that have these views, but are potentially less interested in the national profile and continue to hold the office over and over and over again. So one that comes to mind to me is Chad Bianco, who's the sheriff of Riverside County, which is the county directly east of Los Angeles. The jail that Sheriff Bianco runs is regularly on the list of the places where people die at the highest rates. He has admitted that he is a member of the Oath Keepers. He participates in a broad set of organizations that are really on the right wing fringe, like the Claremont Institute. He's happy being sheriff by all accounts. He's running for re-election again, right? He's going to be sheriff for a long time. he's not going to go on Fox News. He's going to continue to have these views and have power over the people that live in Riverside County and the people that are in his jail and the people that interact with law enforcement there. And so I'm not sure whether one is more concerning or the other, but these are two definite profiles that we see of sheriffs and ways that we might think that these attitudes are really impactful. Is it that these attitudes lead to you having this national profile, or is it that these attitudes lead to you treating the residents of your county in particular?
Although I do think that Bianco might be, he's talking about running for governor. So I don't know. The thrill of moving up might be just too great. But I do agree, there's sheriffs in all kinds of smaller, you know, these rural counties. Half of sheriffs grew up in the county that they live in. The sheriff is the peak of their career, and they're going to stay in that office forever until, you know, there's a sheriff we quote that's like, you got to, like, essentially I have to die in office for you to get me out of this office. And if they do leave, they often resign before the election and essentially hand choose their successor to then run as an interim. Those kinds of places that maybe don't make the news quite as much are also, I think, really difficult. And the ones that aren't as flashy, one of the things we found in our survey is that these attitudes have spread even more so than membership in these kind of national organizations, that sheriffs who aren't necessarily members of MAC's organization, although trying to get a list of that is impossible to do, still believe these ideas. And so for those counties, right, they're going to have a sheriff potentially for a very long time who believe in some of these ideas.
That's an interesting point, that if there's this one potential trajectory represented by Lamb, there's other issues that are brought up just by this kind of the quotidian nature of sheriff's power that's going to continue as it has in the way that you've outlined it in the book, particularly during the second Trump administration. If history holds true, right, we'll probably see less in terms of that challenging of the federal government during this administration. But you also point out that a number of recent developments in law enforcement flow through the sheriff's office in ways I think a lot of people don't understand. And one of those was the enforcement of red flag laws, over which sheriffs have an enormous amount of control in deciding how that works. Could you speak to that issue quickly, being mindful of our time?
Sure. Yeah. So red flag laws are laws put on the books by state legislatures, largely, that say that if somebody is in danger of hurting themselves or others, so if they're suicidal or murderous, this allows for individuals, usually members of their family and law enforcement, to petition to remove firearms from people's possession. In this circumstance, theoretically, this is like a law that's available to everybody, but the reality is that you are much more likely to be successful if you have a law enforcement petitioner as a part of it. And that's largely sheriffs, particularly in rural places in the United States. And sheriffs themselves have expressed, some sheriffs have expressed quite a bit of skepticism about the legality of these red flag laws. Who am I to say that I would take a firearm away from somebody? That seems unconstitutional. And one of the things that we find, a regular pattern that we find in our data, is that sheriffs that endorse these right-wing extremist views are much less likely to say that they approve of the idea of red flag laws and that they would be willing to enforce red flag laws. And we have qualitative examples of this, of sheriffs who are involved in these right-wing movements who have said that they just, quite frankly, are not going to participate in these red flag laws. And this has real consequences for victims of domestic violence, victims of interpersonal violence, because we know that having a firearm in the home dramatically increases the likelihood that there's going to be a murder or a death in domestic violence or spousal abuse situation.
You make such a powerful case in the book for, I think, something that's true, that while we've had this explosion of research into policing, into the carceral state in the last 10 years or so, right, sheriffs and the jails they maintain, right, have really been neglected in that effort. Your book leaves us not only with a powerful analysis, but with this amazing body of data in your appendices, which I had a great time picking through. And it sounds like you're working on another book related to this subject already. I wonder if we could, well, we've got one question we always ask at the end I want to ask after this. But before we get there, I wonder, what do you see right now as the urgent needs in terms of research that is looking at sheriffs and their offices that could follow your work?
Well, I think there's like an endless set of possibilities for that. With 3,000 sheriffs, that's one of the benefits of local politics, is that there's endless cases. And sheriffs are so instrumental, you know, in such a variety of different topics, right? Immigration, domestic violence, gun control. There's really like an endless list for that. There's obviously our work, but other work, you know, that's been out there recently about the role of sheriffs reducing their traffic enforcement mechanisms at the time of elections as a way to ensure re-election is interesting. So more work on kind of like, what do sheriffs do around elections? You know, sheriffs maintain jails. And so that means that most of the folks who are in their custody still have voting rights. And what do sheriffs do in terms of having elections within their own jails and access to elections? I think there's, yeah, so many questions that could be asked.
I think also, you know, I say we broadly being people that think about guns and violence in the United States, I don't know that we have fully investigated questions around white death at the hands of police, particularly in rural areas. Sheriff's offices are the people, sheriff's deputies are the people that kill white people in the United States. And, you know, we don't know a lot about that. We don't know a lot about the causes and consequences of that. We have rightfully so focused a lot on racial inequality in police brutality and shootings and killings. But there are a lot of white people also killed by the police in the United States, and a lot of them are killed by sheriff's deputies. I think that the role of sheriff's offices and jails in particular in providing mental health care and addiction treatment, or not providing those things, particularly in rural areas in the United States, is really important, particularly if we're going to see rolling back of federal funding for policies. Who's going to do these things? And it's going to be sheriffs and people going to rural jails that's going to provide these services.
Yeah. So in closing, we always have these fascinating discussions with authors of new books and like to ask them, what are you reading now that is interesting you, whether on the topic of sheriffs or anything else?
What an interesting question. I just got this great little book by Tim Weaver called Inequality, Crime, and Resistance in New York City, that's thinking a lot about how local governments can offer a different approach to thinking about crime management and why they do and do not offer different approaches to crime management. I'm deep in that right now. I just read that. And Emily and I are working on a new project on corruption and local governments in the United States. So reading lots of things about corruption.
Yeah, I'm in the weeds on corruption right now, I feel. We've gone everywhere from the progressive era to comparative studies of trust of local governments versus federal governments. And, you know, trying to think about contemporary cases of trying to stay up with what's going on with Eric Adams and all these other cases. What is the Department of Justice going to exist next week? So like all in the weeds on corruption.
Wow. Well, we will be looking forward to that book. In the meantime, our guests, Emily Ferris and Miria Holman, their book is The Power of the Badge, Sheriffs and Inequality in the United States, available now from University of Chicago Press. Thanks very much, Emily and Miria.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Had a great time.